Hello everyone, and welcome to the ManaCast, conversations about a vision of life that is truly good news for us, for our neighbours, and for the world. My name is Jacob Garrett, and with me, as always, is Jonathan Cornford.
G'day, folks.
ManaCast is the podcast of ManaGum. It's an organisation where we talk all about the intersection of faith with ecology and economics. Today we're winding the clock way back to look at the first time when Christian faith married to earthly power. And in this and the next couple of episodes, we'll be unpacking the ways in which we still live with the legacy of that first Christian Roman emperor, someone you've probably heard of, Constantine. But before we dive in, we want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands we live and work on. I'm talking to you today, as usual, from Wurundjeri country in Naam or Melbourne in Victoria.
And I'm talking to you from Jar Jar Wurrung country in central Victoria, where it is definitely in the Jar Jar Wurrung season of late summer today. We're having a 37 degree day here. What about you, Jacob?
Yeah, I think it's supposed to get to 37, 38, something like that.
Yeah.
I'm already feeling it.
Going to be a scorcher.
And we'd like to acknowledge these peoples as the traditional custodians of these lands, and we pay our respects to their elders past and present. All right, John. So today we're discussing things that happened almost 2,000 years ago. For many people, that might seem pretty obscure. And yet the reason we're still talking about them today is we still live in the fallout from them. We're going to be asking how we should think about the great changes that Constantine sort of ushered in to the Christian world at the time. And then that sort of leads to Christendom, the medieval period in Europe where Christianity is the dominant religion, 1,000 years, and then those things start to wane and people are still debating how we should think about that stuff today and what the role of the church in politics should be and all that sort of stuff that kind of really gets going with Constantine. But before we can begin interpreting any of that stuff, which we're hoping to do in the next few episodes, we need to know as best we can know, because some of this stuff is hard to know, what actually happened, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. And it's big stuff. And you're right, Jacob, it is still hotly contested. And I guess that's because essentially it gets down to the pretty core questions of the church's relationship to power and to politics, which are still very much live questions for us. So, you know, we're going to begin with talking about Constantine here, but we'll probably end up this series by talking about Scott Morrison.
what a lineage.
Which seems a bit absurd to mention them in the same breath, but there you go, I did it. but you're right, before we can do any of that, we actually just need to get the history straight. And as I think will become evident, at least as I hope will become evident, it's not an easy thing to do. I think we should say at the outset that you know, Jacob and I, we've both read a lot of this sort of history of the Roman Empire and the early church, and even about this event. But neither of us are professional historians, so we're very much talking about this as amateurs. But I guess let me say at the outset, I think the thing I hope that you might come away from this little series is at least the impression that to talk about the changes that happened with Constantine and its effects on us, to come up with any simple story about that and any simple moral conclusion is inadequate. I think if there's anything else that I hope you get from it, it's that, that there's a lot mixed up in this that we need to unravel a bit.
Yeah, he's a very interesting guy in a very complex situation. So it's very, and the sources we have are a little bit sparse or vague for some of the stuff, so it's very hard to know exactly what's going on sometimes.
Yeah, and even when we do, how we interpret it and its meaning and its effects is even then a sometimes even harder question. So we'll begin this episode by we're just going to go through the historical narrative of the rise of Constantine, what actually happened, and try and get as much straight as we can about that. Then in the next episode, we're going to consider some different interpretations of the meaning of that story and the significance of the events and the changes that they brought about. And as you'll see, there's some quite different interpretations out there. And then In the third episode, which is the one we sort of know least about at the moment, is we're going to get to talking, have a bit of a yarn, I guess, about what's all, the meaning of all of this for us here in 21st century Australia. Because I guess the reason we're doing this is the sense that we still live in the legacy of these questions to some extent.
Cool. So let's start by setting the scene. We're going to start way back in the 3rd century, so that's the 200s, and it's sort of, to understand what's going on in the empire at this time will help you understand what's going on for Constantine, what he tries to do, things like that. Historians often refer to most of this century as one long crisis. They even call it the crisis of the 3rd century, and it really begins as a military crisis. There's a new Persian empire in the east that's taken over from the old state there. They're rising in those early 200s. They're called the Sasanians. There are Germanic tribes that are more numerous and more organized up in the north in Germany, and they're pushing on the borders. There's Picts in Scotland. There's African tribes in the south pushing up into the African parts of the Roman Empire. And all this basically makes it very hard to govern because you're trying to fight wars on multiple fronts. It leads to economic crises. It leads to political crises. You have lots of emperors in this period who, some of them get assassinated. Sometimes multiple armies are proclaiming multiple people emperor at different times.
Actually, don't lots of them get assassinated? It's actually a really bad time to be a Roman emperor.
Yeah, pretty much all of them. And sometimes by their own bodyguards. So it's not really an ideal situation. And you've got even breakaway states at certain points, people declaring their own smaller empires as part of the Roman Empire. And there's a bit of persecution that ramps up toward Christians in this time, as well as other minority groups, because the empire is really on the rocks. They're looking for someone to blame. They're trying to create unity, and people who aren't part of the mainstream are getting a lot more hassled and a lot more villainized and scapegoated. And so it really starts to pick up. The empire starts to like come back a little bit in sort of the 270s, late in the century. There's this series of emperors who just wage constant wars, both against those sort of rival claimants inside the empire, as well as against the Persians and against the Germans. And eventually that all culminates in this guy called Diocletian in 284. He takes the throne and he basically goes, we've got to do something about this. This place is ungovernable. It's too big. There's too many borders. I can't be everywhere at once. I can't run everything. So he takes the novel step of dividing the empire into four. He goes east and west. That's one division. He takes the east. That's the richer, more powerful part. And he sets up his mate in the west. And then each of them have a kind of like junior emperor, like an understudy who takes part of the control of their portion of the empire as well. And the understanding is they'll become the big dog after the older guys pass on. And Diocletian is a really interesting character. He rules for 20 years and he actually, contrary to the emperors who have gone before him, he retires and he dies peacefully, which I think is a testament to his ability, because pretty much everyone else got killed either in battle or by their own soldiers or bodyguards.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say he's a big turning point in this history, the story that we're about to tell. So after the crisis of the 3rd century, it's really Diocletian who brings things back to some order. And actually, a lot of people would say he saved the Roman Empire at that period.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It could have easily crumbled into smaller states or just disappeared entirely in some way. It could have been overrun, all sorts of things. So Diocletian, he basically sets up the new order. Simultaneously, he innovates as well as wants to go back to the way things were. He's an interesting figure. And it's quite an effective system, this four emperors with two major and two minor. It's called the Tetrarchy, for four in Greek. But it really only works when Diocletian's in control, because once he retires and those next junior guys become the top dogs, there's a lot of jostling. There's a lot of suspicion among them. Nobody really knows exactly who's fully in command, and everyone's trying to get a better position amongst each other.
So I think it's safe to say that although as effective as Diocletian was, he held order together while he was in the job, but He seriously underestimated the quest for glory of the Roman military elite and how powerful that was amongst generally and what he would unleash.
Definitely. So everyone's trying to set up their own preferred successor to the next bottom, the job down, the junior emperor job, who will hopefully become the emperor when they move on, all this sort of thing. And one of those junior emperors is a guy called Constantius, and that's Constantine's dad. And he's in the West, he's in sort of Gaul, which is modern day France. He campaigns in Britain. And Constantine is raised partly as a political hostage away from his father, and partly with his father on campaign. So he grows up in this kind of, he's born in the 270s. He grows up in this climate of war and instability and very, very vicious political jostling.
Okay, so that's this is where Constantine enters the story, but we probably need to pause that story before we go any further, because what we ultimately want to get to is to talk about Constantine and his relationship to Christianity. So we need to say something first about what the state of the church is at this period and through the third century going into the beginning, the turning point of the fourth century. So so of course, the church at this time is at this time not wholly, but Christians. There are some Christians who are now beyond the bounds of the Roman Empire, but most, the vast majority of those Christians that there are, live within the Roman Empire. So everything the Roman Empire is going through, they're going through to some extent. How many are they? This a debated subject. The sort of figure you often hear thrown around is that by the beginning of the fourth century, there might be 10% of the Roman Empire is Christians, and that's been a lot of people who use that figure. I've read some stuff more recently that really brings that into question, and one guy revises it down to 2%.
But not many.
Which is, well, not many, but it's actually still quite a lot when you think about the beginnings of Christianity and the repression it's facing. But either way, somewhere between 2 to 10%, we don't know, is what we ultimately have to say.
Yeah.
And I just mentioned their repression. So it's in, people might know of the persecution that Nero unleashed on Christians way back in 64 AD, when according to tradition, at least, that's when both Peter and Paul were martyred in Rome. But up until the third century, there hasn't been anything like systematic persecutions, have there, Jacob?
No, it's really under one of those emperors that rules for only a little time, a guy called Decius, that the first kind of like programmatic or institutional persecution goes on. Decius has some people executed. It's probably not, it's, well, my lecturer at uni said it was probably in the hundreds to thousands rather than, you know, heaps and heaps and heaps of Christians. And it was probably the most prominent people, and it was probably to set an example. But there definitely were executions, and along with executions goes, you know, knocking down churches, confiscation of property, holy books, this sort of stuff. So it's definitely not easy to be a Christian at times and places in the Roman Empire.
And the next great persecution is that of Diocletian, right?
Yeah, there's a little one under Valerian, and then Diocletian enacts another one, and his successor kind of pushes that again. And it's, again, it's similar. It's, there's some execution and imprisonment of prominent leaders. There's destruction of churches. There's confiscation of property. And basically, it seems like all these rulers are worried that these Christians represent a kind of fifth column within the empire. There's religious worry as well, because of course the order of things is related to your relationship to the divine powers. So if you've got people worshipping the wrong gods, that actually is a national security problem. But yeah, it's got to do with this kind of like, well, why is this all happening to us now? And who are these people who aren't singing from the same song sheet? What can we do about them?
Yeah, and look, I think it's worth getting things straight a little bit around persecution and repression, because there's sort of, it's gone a couple of ways in the historical debate. So for a long time, you know, it was, you had the persecution of Nero and these systematic persecutions of Decius and Diocletian. And, you know, there was strong narrative out there that Christianity was a persecuted religion before Constantine. Then it sort of swung the other way when a bunch of historians said, well, hang on, that's only like four, or maybe we might count Valerian's as a fifth persecution happening over 300 years. That's not that much, really. You know, Christianity wasn't really that persecuted. And to some extent, the concept of persecutions and how that may have been portrayed in Hollywood has been overstated. But they were real and they were pretty big for the people who went through them. But actually, what both of those things leave out of the picture is the much more stable and ongoing reality of just of repression going through of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire. And I was about to say low-key repression, but that's only by the standards of the sort of Hollywood versions of persecution. When we're talking about repression, we're talking about you could just be whipped and have all of your belongings taken off you, you know, whipped quite brutally for being a Christian and for refusing to denounce Christ at any point in time in those 300 years. So if that happens to you, that's a pretty big event in your life. So that's not low-key at all.
But yeah, you're right. The narrative about it, you know, there's the romantic image, which did happen at points of like the Christians in the amphitheater to the lions kind of thing. But there's also just like the ongoing day by day, you know, it's frowned upon. Some people might refuse to do business with you or hike up the prices. The government might come and hassle you in various ways. And what hassle means, as you say, could be quite significant. Yeah, it's not one thing across everywhere. And even like we see with Constantine's dad, he might not have been a Christian, but in his sort of quarter of the empire for his rule, he noticeably doesn't give the Christians as much trouble as the other three emperors at the time. So it seems like he's got some sort of sympathy there. He knocks down some churches probably, but yeah, he's not as harsh as the other guys.
What's also interesting to note is the emperors who do... So practice either persecution or do, you know, demand some sort of repression of Christianity. It's not just your Nero figures who, you know, perhaps have been a bit overblown, but was, you know, clearly a pretty cruel and sadistic guy. But actually a bunch of the other emperors were some of those who people would see as the most reasonable, just, most effective emperors, those most concerned with order, law, and justice. So guys like Diocletian that we've mentioned. So most historians would see him as a very good, fair, just emperor. And also, so going back to, so one of the earliest evidences we have of the sort of ongoing repression for Christianity is from through some letters between the Emperor Trajan and one of his bureaucrats out in the provinces, a guy called Pliny the Younger. And these are, in the terms of the Roman Empire, these are the sophisticated, educated, cultured people. They're not barbarians by any means, and yet they're very clearly talking about, well, we should. These people are a bit weird and they're a bit subversive because they don't do what we tell them to. We tell them to renounce this funny god of theirs, and they don't. So that's just bad. So let's whip them and take all their stuff off them.
Yeah. And I've actually written about that exchange of letters that has survived remarkably between Pliny and Trajan in Manor Matters. If you want to check that out, there's a November 2021 edition. You'll find it in there. We should also say, I guess, John, that like not only is persecution or repression different among different places and times and under different emperors, but also what Christianity is not a fixed thing at this time. You've got people who these days we would say are heretics, but at the time they considered themselves Christians, and sort of people knowing them would have understood that they were Christians. That's what a Christian is. We don't have any single institution that's calling the shots about dogma or theology.
Yes, excellent point. So that's to come to now what the Christianity is and what the church is. So yeah, it's a highly diverse movement. And there are certainly been a series of, you know, debates and arguments amongst different thinkers and bishops and leaders in the church. Even that word bishop we have to use carefully because it doesn't mean what it later comes to mean at this stage. And still at this stage, the structures of the church, who has authority where, all this is a bit contested and it's a bit different depending where you live. There's no such thing at this point in time as a pope. So there's a bishop in Rome, but people certainly don't see him as the leader of the church. There's nothing at this stage like an agreed set of beliefs that we will end up with by the end of this podcast. So there's, you know, the people are working towards that. There's certainly a lot of writing debate going on. What should we believe? They have to talk about what books will make up our New Testament. That's a big subject of debate. So that's one of the things. But yeah, so there's no single institution we can call the church, but rather this is a very grassroots and grassroots minority repressed movement with a whole bunch of different leaders that make up this thing called Christianity.
Mm. Yeah, and it's definitely... it's not obvious what's going to happen in the next 20, 30, 40 years from sort of where we're talking, the early 300s. It's not really obvious that Christianity is going to rise to the prominent place that it eventually did by sort of 380, when a later emperor, Theodosius, makes it the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Okay, so we need to go there. So how does that all come about? Start telling us the story of the rise of Constantine, Jacob.
Yeah, so... definitely, like, he's born into an interesting circumstance, as we sort of said. There's war, there's jostling for power, there's rebels within the empire who are breaking off little chunks of it and trying to rule it as their own independent kingdom. And even if you are officially one of those four guys, the tetrarchy, you're looking over your shoulder, seeing if the other guys want to oust you or get their own guy in the job. And so Constantine, he was born of a pretty low status Greek woman called Helena. It's possible she was Christian or became Christian in later life. We don't really know. But like I said about his dad's sympathetic, maybe, attitude towards Christianity, there might have been some Christian faith going around in his household or his family. But for a time, he lives apart from his dad. He's in the court of Diocletian, so he's learning the ropes of how to really get things done. But he's also kind of a political hostage, making sure his dad does what Diocletian wants. And eventually, he escapes from his hostage situation under the next emperor after Diocletian, and he runs off to his dad, and he joins him on campaign. And that's great, except his dad dies pretty much only a year later. And the army that loves his dad and sees Constantine as the reincarnation almost of his dad, or the next version of his dad, goes, great! Constantine, you're our guy. We love you. You're going to be emperor. You're going to be emperor of the whole Western half. And the Eastern emperor doesn't like this at all, but he kind of can't do anything about it because that army is one of the biggest and strongest armies in the whole empire. And he knows that it's just going to be bad news if he tries to contest it. So he allows it for a while. Constantine writes this letter saying, oh, you know, what could I do? The army made me emperor. And, you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, it is my dad who was the emperor, even though I wasn't slated for this job. I think I'd be suitable. And as we said about the Tetrarchy, it's after Diocletian, it's inherently unstable. Everyone wants the top job. No one knows who to trust. And it all falls apart. Various emperors rebel.
It's pretty clear from about this point, though, Jacob, that Constantine is pretty ambitious, right?
Oh, absolutely. Like, he was already governor of Dalmatia, which is in the Balkans. And yeah, he's clearly a very cluey guy. He knows how to lever things for his own gain. He knows how to work a propaganda machine up in the West. He's got a lot of popularity in sort of his home turf of Spain and France and Britain. And so when he makes a bid for absolute power in the West, he goes up against someone who's rebelling in Italy, calling himself the emperor, a guy called Maxentius. And they fight a very famous battle at the Milvian Bridge, this bridge over the river Tiber, right near Rome. And that's where Constantine has his famous dream where, well, we don't really know what happened, but maybe it happens before the battle. Maybe it happens like way before versus just before. And he sees this symbol, the Greek letters for C and H in, or C and R, really, it's C, H and R, the Chi Rho. And it says, the dream figure says, in this sign, thou shalt conquer. And sort of, there you go. But what does the CHR mean? What does Chi Rho mean? It's kind of associated with the sun cult. It's kind of associated with Jesus because it's the first three letters of Christ, or two letters in Greek of Christ. And so it's a little bit ambiguous. We don't know if Constantine becomes a Christian then or whatever. But either way, he defeats this guy Maxentius, and he becomes the undisputed ruler in the western half of the Roman Empire.
Okay, so this is 312 AD. It's the famous Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And after this vision, he's supposed to have had his soldiers paint the Cairo on their shields as the standard that they go into battle with. And they have what is clearly, that's not disputed at all, a pretty emphatic victory, one that ensures that Constantine is now top dog.
It is not close. Constantine clearly knows his way around military command. Yep. And that's shown later as well when the eastern half is ruled by this guy called Licinius. And they have a little bit of friendship for a while. They even put together the Edict of Milan, which is about religious tolerance and says Christians can have back their confiscated property. So they work together for a little while, but it's not long before open war breaks out between those two. The empire doesn't seem like it can really be ruled in two halves. And that really comes to a head in 324. So about 10 years later, Constantine, again, decisive victory against Licinius after a few other battles. And so for the first time in 40 years since Diocletian, the empire now has just one top dog, one emperor.
And it's so from here on, it's important to say that Constantine is, as an emperor, incredibly effective. So he's a very successful empire. So we've already heard he's incredibly successful as a military leader. And he continues that as an emperor. Both, not only does he win the civil wars, but he, you know, keeps the Persians and the barbarians at bay, does very well on the frontiers of Rome. But he's also a really good administrator and organizer. He finishes Diocletian's job of reforming the tax system and reforming the coinage, has a big impact on the financial system, gets the economy back on a secure and stable footing. He's very significant, and even, and just as important, he sets up a very successful and stable dynasty. So for the next 100 years or so, we have pretty stable successions between emperors.
Yeah, which is something that basically never happened in the 200s until Diocletian stepped in.
Yeah, so, you know, for the next 100 years or so, that Rome is fairly well governed. And it all goes back to, well, Diocletian began the reforms, but it's really Constantine who cements it all and brings it to fruition.
Yeah, and there's pretty much not a part of the Roman state that he didn't reach into. Like you said, it's finance, it's religion, it's politics, it's military, it's all sorts of things he has a hand in. He even founds the famous city Constantinople on the site that was Byzantium, because he's got a head for strategic architecture and geography, and he understands this is going to be an important place to set up my base.
So by the standards of most historians, he would be considered up there, you know, maybe in the top five of the most effective Roman emperors ever. There's not too much dispute about that. What there is dispute about is the nature of his faith, and that's where we need to go now. So you've mentioned this vision he has before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and it's sort of legendary. It is legendary, and it's, you know, the idea that this Roman general just has this vision from Christ then goes into battle under the banner of Christ and is astoundingly triumphant and ends up becoming sole emperor by 324. And it's clear that he's been, you know, he's God's ordained, he's been blessed. What is clear, I think what most, it's certainly not disputed that Constantine was a Christian emperor. So I think everyone agrees on that. What is not so clear, there's a few things that are not so clear. One is, when did he become a Christian? That's an interesting question. So, two, when did he actually come out as a Christian is another interesting question. And I think even the most interesting question is, what sort of Christian was he? So just in terms of the, you know, when we say he was a Christian, what are we actually saying? So there are three sorts of things to be explored. And then there's the question of the significance of his impact upon what Christianity became and what the Christian church became. So there's no dispute that Constantine becoming the first Christian emperor changed everything for Christianity and for the church in a big way. But the big disputes are, what was the nature of that? And, you know, to put it in as crude as terms, was that a good thing or was that a bad thing? So they're the sorts of questions, right? We're not going to get to the questions of understanding it, but we do want to talk about the nature of his faith. So where should we pick that up, Jacob?
Yeah, well, I think it's probably worth starting with that it seems like there's some sort of Christian belief in the family, but also he doesn't just come out and say in very clear terms, I'm a Christian from whatever the beginning would be, or even really any point. I mean, he convenes the Council of Nicaea in 325, which is that famous council where all these bishops from around the empire get together and decide what are we actually going to say about predominantly Jesus theologically. But at that point, he's not a baptized Christian. He can't take communion with those bishops. He is kind of doing that in his political capacity rather than as a participating Christian in those discussions or, you know, with a overt horse in that race.
Mm. Okay, so a few things to pick up there. So one, it's not clear when he becomes a Christian. And so, you know, by some versions and by the traditional account, he converts just before the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. That's when he's not a Christian.
That big vision.
He has a vision of Christ and basically goes into a battle under the banner of Christ. And then once he goes into Rome, he calls up some bishops and says, so who is this God I'm now worshipping?
Who's just given me victory.
Effectively. Tell me about him.
So that's... But even then, like with Licinius and the Edict of Milan, like the language in that edict, I mean, maybe he's just doing it for sort of spreading the net as wide as possible, but they're very vague about divinity in that. They're kind of like, everyone can worship, but, you know...
Yeah, look, I think that word vague is the key actually in the whole thing. So actually, there are some people who think it's more likely that Constantine was raised from perhaps by his mother as some sort of Christian or had some contact with this concept allegiance to a new god called Christus. And this had been part of his makeup. But it's clear he's not a part of the church. He's not a part of a Christian community. He hasn't been in those structures and it becomes clear that though, you know, he has to learn what that's all about. So he's not a Christian in the normal sense of the word, but perhaps someone has been converted somewhere. And then there's this sense in the family, there's this other God that you could worship. And some people do. And what is pretty clear about Constantine, as you said, he's pretty cluey. And, you know, there's all these things being shaken up. And so he's shaking up the tetrarchy. And one thing you sort of need if you're making a big decisive move to be the guy, then you need something big and decisive behind you. And to declare for a new God is one of the things you can do, right? In this world, because it's gods that give you victory, right? And if you're a victorious military commander, that's one thing. But if you can say that you've been given that victory by a god, and this is the god, and my god is different from their god, so that sets a clear line between us, then, you know, that it has a bigger social and political significance. So there's that behind it. But then there's the whole question of the vagueness of right through this period, both Milvian Bridge and for the next decade or so of actually who the god is, because to start with, there's some suggestion it's Apollo, right? And then it's the Sol Invictus, the sun god, and there's some sort of relationship between those two, right? Have I got that right?
That would make sense. I mean, Apollo's the light bringer, so I imagine they've been blended.
You know, so is this Sol Invictus? And at times, so Sol Invictus that Constantine does use that symbol in some of his coinage. And he certainly doesn't just come out and say, I'm a Christian after the Battle of Melvin Bridge. And in fact, what seems to be the case is he seems to tailor his communications to his audience very carefully.
And he does some things to please some people. He does other things to seemingly please other crowds.
Yeah.
And he has this very careful and seemingly calculated blend, at least in his public face,
and in fact,
of his allegiance.
The story of the conversion that we told is one that is the account of a guy called Eusebius, was Eusebius a bishop, or what was he?
I think he did become a bishop at one point. I can't remember, but he was certainly a chronicler.
Yeah, churchman, chronicler of the church, and who he is just Constantine's hagiographer, really. He sings Constantine's praise, and
he loves the guy.
His story of Constantine's conversion, and actually that story was unknown in the Western Empire for a good 10 to 20 years. So it's the question is, did Eusebius really make up that story? There's a couple of other stories. I forget the details of what happened at the Milvian Bridge and and also how Constantine became a Christian. He has a different account that he gives himself, which is more vague. Essentially what is clear is we have a progression of coming out as a Christian from beginning at the Milvian Bridge, but very vaguely there. He's certainly not saying I'm a Christian at that stage. He says that there's a new God. He's got a new God behind him, but he talks about, you know, the great divinity. And then bit by bit, depending on who he's talking to, he might mention when he talks a bit to the bishops, to the Christians, he mentions God and even has some coins minted in North Africa, which is a highly Christian area, which has some sort of mention of Christ on it. But in other, most of his coinage has Sol Invictus for a while, for example. It's not really until he has final victory in 324, is it? Against Licinius that he fully comes out and says, yep, I'm Christian, and it's and that's part of his decrees, part of his persona, that is really settled.
Yeah, and if you're a Christian who's just gone through the persecutions of Diocletian and Diocletian's successor, you're like some of the people at the Council of Nicaea, some of the bishops have scars from being tortured by these guys. It's understandable that these guys are like, whoa, this is great news.
Yes, yes.
Suddenly, our guy, a guy of our faith, is in the top job across the whole empire.
Absolutely. Yeah, because where we're going to get to in the next episode is that, you know, there is, and for good, very good reasons, a lot of people who are very critical of this moment in history and its impact on Christianity. But it is, I think, really important to ask, if we were there, you know, and we'd lived through Diocletian's persecution, what would we think? How would we think about this new shift?
Yeah, you'd be pretty inclined to believe that Constantine, this guy who was given victory, you know, has just become top dog kind of out of nowhere. I mean, he wasn't even set up for the job. And now he's saying he's a Christian. You'd be thinking, well, yeah, he probably does have God behind him. Maybe this really is our guy.
Or at least if you're unsure, you'd be thinking, well, let's just see how this guy goes because it's definitely better than what we had before.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the sorts of questions I think we sort of need to ask to keep it real, I think. But also, I think it is important to be a bit clear about what kind of Christian he was. So one of the really interesting things about Constantine is that so after his battle in Milvian Bridge, he does get together some bishops and priests, I think, and he basically has a period of talking to them to learn a bit more about Christianity. He's starting to we don't really know what he knows, but he goes from this time on, it becomes clear he begins to study Christianity. But he makes a really interesting decision, which is he breaks off any move towards baptism. So now it's important to stress how strange this is for someone who's saying they're a Christian, because when we talked about what is Christianity at this stage and what does it mean to be a Christian, Baptism is at the center of how Christians understand what it means to be a Christian. So by the standards of the early church, you weren't converted until you were baptized. So by the standards of the early church, what the story we've just told, Constantine pledging his allegiance to Christ at Milvian Bridge is not a conversion. That's just the beginning of a story. Conversion is something that happens. So third century, there's this process. If you start to say, okay, I'm interested in this Christ figure, then there's a very well and very highly intensive program of what was called catechesis, which is a process of you'd have a mentor who would be someone that you knew and who was a Christian and who could guide you. And then you'd have instructors who basically teach you about Christianity. And this could go for anywhere between 1 to 3 years. And it was depending where you were, that might involve you going daily for teaching, or it might be a couple of times a week. But it was intensive. And you had to go through this process. And there were some big hurdles for you to go get over. So it wasn't just you had to learn, you know, you had to learn some, this is the doctrine, and tick boxes and say, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Actually, what they were really looking at is the ethical standard of your life. What are you doing in your life? And are you ready to follow Christ with how you're living your life? And so there are some, we'll get to this in the next episode, but for example, you know, in some parts of the Christian world, and we don't know exactly how widespread, but in a good number of them, for example, if you were a soldier and you wanted to become a Christian, you either had to try and get out of the military, or you had to swear that you would not be involved in violence, which is pretty hard if you're a soldier. But you could
pretty tricky also if you're a military emperor.
Exactly. So this is where we're getting to. So it's an incredibly high ethical standard, and I mean, it's Christianity at this time is something entirely foreign from our own experience of it. That the idea that there's these huge, high ethical bars for you to meet. To belong to this community and being a Christian
before you're really allowed in,
before you could get baptized, and baptism was what allowed you to belong to the community, and which is what allowed you to take the Eucharist. So you weren't a Christian until you'd, part of the definition of being Christian was one, being baptized, and two, belonging to the community and sharing in the Eucharist. So Constantine, by that definition, was not a Christian until. And this is the really, he deferred baptism right up until the last weeks of his life. And we have to ask, was that because it becomes pretty clear to him that by what, once they start explaining baptism to him and saying, well, this is what you do, this is what catechesis is, and these sort of questions, he goes, ah, there is no way I can be, I've just landed up as emperor, which is what I want to do. And you're saying I basically can't be a Roman emperor anymore.
Yeah, I'd have to quit my job.
Now, maybe I'm putting that too boldly and we're pushing some of those questions too hard too early. But I just want to, I guess, at least get a sense of what might have been going on there, you know. And we have to confess we don't know. And it's too, you know, too far. The sources are too weak and the too... fragmentary, they say different things at different times too. So, look, I've pushed that in one direction, but there are these questions. Why does he defer baptism? This is unique. So this is a unique, so when we say what sort of Christian was he was a new kind of Christian. That's for one thing for a start. And that will become really important to the sort of changes we talk about in the next episode.
And you say like moral standards. It's the story is a little bit hazy, and because he's such a famous figure, the people writing the history are often writing it on his side, but it's possible he had his wife and his son killed, potentially because his son was sort of being seditious and maybe his wife was involved in that. We don't really know, but like if he did, it calls into question quite a bit of that moral character we're talking about that's a prerequisite to be a member of the community as well.
Oh, there's no doubt he was a brutal emperor. So when we said he was a very good emperor and effective, that one of the things that goes with being an effective Roman emperor is being brutal. So he has many members of his family killed, actually. He's generally recognized as, so, well, I've seen the word bloodthirsty. used by different historians. I think that might be a bit harsh by the standards of the time, but certainly he had lots of blood on his hands, and we're talking about murders and executions. He certainly had his wife and oldest son executed. We don't know exactly why, probably for the in the case of the oldest son to do some, he was seen as a threat. And certainly we also know that his own children in the coming towards a succession, when they're when he dies, they begin to immediately murder a whole bunch of their relatives to make sure that they don't become relatives, and they ensure the succession is clean and solid and not contested.
But I remember studying this in Bible college and arguing with my lecturer a little bit, who was kind of saying, well, you know, he's a Christian. And I'm saying, well, what kind of Christian murders their own family members? And he's sort of going, well, that kind of comes with the job and kind of comes with the times. Like, what do? You can't have potential other claimants to the throne running around in your family. That's just how it has to happen. You know, there's this kind of compromised assessment of Constantine there that he's willing to accept that just comes with the job.
And therein lies the rub. And that is really at the core of the questions that we will need to begin asking to set up the questions for the next episode. So maybe we should finish it there, looking forward ahead to the sorts of the dilemmas of what does it mean to have an emperor who's a Christian, or what does it mean to have a Christian who's an emperor, and how can these things go together? And so there's just a philosophical question, but then there's the actual history of what Constantine, and particularly Constantine and his successors, his dynasty, do for the next 100 years, and how they shape the church, and then how that sets up the story of Christendom, and then what's the meaning of all of this? You know, was it a good thing or was it a bad thing, or was there a bit of good and a bit of bad? They're the sorts of questions we'll be asking.
And there's lots of opinions to cover. But that's indeed. that's easily enough, I think, for this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you liked this episode, please send it along to a friend, review us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. And if you want more good news economics in the meantime, you should check out Manor Matters. That's the quarterly publication of Manor Gum. It comes out online and in post 3 times a year for free. You can find it at manorgum.org.au. Manor Gum's also a ministry funded entirely by donations. So if you'd like to support the work we do, things like this podcast and Manor Matters, that same website is the place to go to, manorgum.org.au. Thanks to everyone who does donate. You really make all the difference to make this possible. We'll leave you today with just a little taste of one commentator on the legacy we've been discussing, a guy called John Howard Yoder from his book The Priestly Kingdom. And he is very cautious about what's sometimes called the Constantinian shift.
That's an understatement.
And just like what we were saying about, can you have a ruler who's a Christian? Can you have a Christian who's an emperor? He says this: after Constantine, the ruler, not the average person or the weak person, is the model for ethical deliberations. A moral statement on the rightness of truth-telling or the wrongness of killing is tested first by whether a ruler can meet such standards. He does not think a ruler can meet such standards.
No.
Hopefully you join us for the next episode. Thank you, John. I really enjoyed this discussion.
Thank you, Jacob.
We'll see you guys next time.